you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, Scott Horton's show, scotthorton.org/interviews, 4,400-something interviews for you there, going back to 2003. Also, libertarianinstitute.org/scotthortonshow. All the latest stuff goes there first. So sign up for the feed there, libertarianinstitute.org/scotthortonshow. And follow me on Twitter, @scotthortonshow. And, hey, if you guys are interested in the Q&A stuff, that's me answering your questions, then ask me, #SHSQA. On Twitter, or email me, scott@scotthorton.org, and then all those are going up at scotthorton.org/show, and you can sign up for the feed there, and we're doing the Q&A stuff, especially for those of you who missed the live show and the me talking parts. There are some of you out there. All right. Introducing our good old friend, Mohammed Sahimi. It must be nice, Mohammed, to not feel like you have to debunk lies about the Iranian nuclear program day after day for a change. Am I right?
It is perfect. It is perfectly a relief not to be on alert all the time and just write articles revealing all the lies and exaggerations about Iran's nuclear program. Unfortunately, that has left the scene for now, at least. So there are other important things to write about and talk about.
Right. Well, and of course, the lies about the nuclear program never go all the way away, so we have to be vigilant. But, yeah, no, it's really great to read your insight. This great article, everybody, is at the Huffington Post, and I don't know if we already ran it at antiwar.com or we're going to, or I think we're linking to it today or we're running it as original. I can't keep track anymore, but it's definitely at Huffington Post. It's called Iran's Deep State Could Unseat Rouhani. That's the current president of Iran. With Khamenei, that's the current supreme leader, backed hardliner in upcoming elections. And then, I'm sorry, I forgot to say, Mohammed is a professor of chemical engineering at USC. He's written for antiwar.com for years and for many other places about Iranian politics and especially the truth about their civilian nuclear program, etc. So, anyway, here we get to these two major leaders in Iran, the president and the supreme leader, Rouhani and Khamenei. And now there's a presidential election and he's up for re-election, right? And then, but this is also coincides with an election for the council of men that pick the next supreme leader. Is that correct?
No, actually, this is coincides with the city council that run cities all over Iran. And it's actually a very important election, although we don't talk about it here, because these three councils have a lot of local power, and they also play a role in the presidential elections and the elections for the parliament, because out of these city councils, committees are formed to look at the candidates and so on. And as we say in this country, our politics is local, at least some people say. It is the same in Iran. So these elections are also important. But the most important elections are what you just mentioned, and that is the presidential election, which will be held on May 19th. So it's about exactly 6 weeks from today. And there is, as usual, very fierce competition between various factions. But what is surprising and to some extent unexpected to some, at least, although I must say not to me because I follow Iranian politics very closely, is the emergence of this ultra-hardliner as a candidate that is apparently supported by the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei also. In the article, I talk about the Iranian deep state. I mean, we all know that many countries have deep state, namely a group of people that pull strings behind the scene. They have a lot of influence, and they put out things through their front line or whatever, public front line or whatever we call them, to influence things. and Iran is no exception. In Iran, we have secret and sort of semi-secret networks of intelligence, security, and military officers and agents, and their supporters among hardline clerics and a small fraction of people, about perhaps 10% as elections indicate, that try to influence things from behind behind the scene. These guys were also opposed to nuclear agreement between Iran and 5+1. Excuse me. They also are opposed to opening the political space in Iran and move towards democratization. They also have a very hardline positions regarding what's happening in Iraq and Syria and Yemen and other places in the Middle East. And therefore, the emergence of a candidate by that is supported by this group and apparently by Khamenei can have great influence not only on Iranian elections on May 19, but also the aftermath of it, because if he gets elected somehow, then everything in the Middle East regarding Iran's influence and intervention in the Middle East will be affected. And therefore, for people like me who want Iran not to really intervene in the affairs of other countries in the Middle East and just try to rebuild itself and move towards democratization, this is of major concern. So that was one motivation that I wrote that article, and I'm going to write more articles until the elections.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so the background of this, part of the background of this would be the nuclear deal with the P5+1, as you said. And I guess, well, the couple of questions. The first one would be, you know, just how much the nuclear deal, the politics of the nuclear deal have to do with, you know, the kind of overall sentiment in the country, whether they're leaning more toward Rouhani, the president, and people in his faction, or in other words, if they feel like they're not getting the results from the nuclear deal that they thought they would get in terms of sanctions and economic relief, then, you know, perhaps they'll be more jaded against the so-called reformers, the ones who are easier for the empire to get along with anyway, whatever you call them. And all that. So, I mean, we've kind of heard that the Americans have been dragging their feet on these sanctions all along. So how does that play in here?
Okay, the sentiment towards nuclear agreement in Iran, as I understand it, can be put into two groups. One part of it, people generally agree that the nuclear agreement was good for Iran because they take a look at the rest of the Middle East and see that practically everywhere that is of importance, war is going on. I mean, in Iraq, we have war in Syria, in Yemen, even in Turkey between Kurdish opposition and the government. And, of course, in Lebanon, we always have tension and so on. So they think that because of the nuclear agreement, for now, Iran is safe and away from the war zone. So in that sense, everybody supported the nuclear agreement. The other part of it was the economic relief that people expected to get from the nuclear agreement. But that hasn't happened to a large extent. And the reason for it, at least one reason for it, is what you mentioned. And that was that is the fact that the U.S., even during the last year of Obama administration, dragged its feet in order to lift the nuclear-related sanctions. At the same time, economic sanctions were very complex. They may seem simple on the surface, but there are all sorts of regulations, rules, international agreement, and so on that have to be adjusted in order, for example, for Iranian bank to have access to their account in European and East Asian banks. In order for Iran, for example, to get to back to the level of oil exporting before the sanctions, a lot of things have to be done because Iran was exporting oil to many European countries. But after Iranian oil sanctions, the refineries in Europe that were refining Iranian oil had to adjust for several months in order to import oil from other places. to refine. In refinery oil operation, you cannot simply stop taking one type of oil and then use another type of oil. It needs adjustment. So in that case, increase of Iran's oil exports have been slow. So the economic relief that Iranian people expected hasn't materialized to a large extent. And therefore, in that sense, some people are happy. But at the same time, Iranians also recognize that this is not, at least to a major extent, not Rouhani administration fault. They have been trying to do their best to remove all the barriers against commerce and lifting the economic sanctions and so on, so that Iran can get back on its feet. The hardliners, on the other hand, are not happy with the nuclear agreement. They think that Iran gave up too much and received too little. At the same time, what I call the deep state is also deeply angered at Rouhani, not only because of the nuclear agreement, but also because of the fact that Rouhani administration, unlike the Ahmadinejad administration before the current administration, awarded many, many large contracts, internal economic projects, to many companies, corporations inside Iran that were linked with military officers and all the people that are behind the scene influencing things.
Mm-hmm.
And Rouhani stopped that. So that means that he also cut off a major source of income that they have. And remember, when these guys have all these big resources at their disposal, they can use those resources and influence elections, for example. Just as in this country, a lot of rich people and corporations try to buy votes through all these political action committees and this and that, the same thing happens in Iran. They can, distribute cash among poor people and say, on the election they go and vote for this. So that also has hurt them, which is another reason for them to be deeply angry at the current administration and trying to remove Rouhani from presidency.
Yeah, that's such an important insight there. Not only is war and conflict the health of the state, it's the health of the worst parts of the state. So just as you and I spoke about for years, Mohammed, that guess who's benefiting from the sanctions regime inside Iran while the regular people suffer?
Exactly.
The Quds Force and the Revolutionary Guard Corps and all the most right-wing reactionary secret police in the country, they're the ones who run the black markets, of course. They're the gangsters at the top of the pyramid, so they control all this underworld activity. So by legalizing trade, basically, by lifting the sanctions, what you're saying is by making this deal to get the sanctions lifted, you're saying the current president of Iran has angered all these underworld actors, all the worst people on the Iranian government right that we would very much like to see lose. He made them lose, but now he's getting a reaction from them. And we're going to see whether they're going to let him get away with making peace, which costs them personally.
I totally agree. As you said, when the Obama administration began imposing sanctions, people like you, myself, many other people, we talked about it. I wrote many articles that, these sanctions that you are imposing on Iran will actually make the hardliners are stronger because they use this as an excuse to, first of all, justify their incompetence, secondly, use it for their economic benefit. The black market in Iran was vast during the sanctioned regime. They controlled their own routes for importing things illegally from outside world. They benefited greatly. At that time, it was estimated that about 90% of Iran's black market is controlled by entities that were linked to hardliners, to these underground militant organizations, and so on. And about 60% of the official economy that was controlled by the government was also controlled by these guys because Ahmadinejad was basically one of them. So under the excuse that we have sanctions, so we have to rely on our own people and so on, he granted, without any bidding or any competition, large projects to these guys. Now, all of it, or at least most of it, is gone now. And therefore, these people have reacted. They are very angry, and therefore they want to remove Rouhani. Now, let me just point out here that for a guy like me, it's not that Rouhani is the ideal candidate. Of course, not. If I were in Iran and Iran was a democracy, I would never vote for Rouhani. But just like everywhere else, including in this country, you always vote between bad and worse, or worse and the worst. So between Rouhani, who believes in a moderate foreign policy and tries to open up Iran to some extent and have better relationship with Iran's neighbors and so on, and the hardliners who want to continue suppressing Iranian people and control all aspects of national economy and social life and so on, I would definitely prefer a guy like Rouhani. So it is a question of which one will help better for a better future for Iranian people in the long run. Mm-hmm. And under present condition, Rouhani is, of course, the better candidate.
Right. Well, and this is, really crystallizes the fact that the moderates, the quote-unquote moderates, the ones who, look good on TV and can deal with Americans on a level that doesn't make them too upset or whatever, those are always considered the enemy, the paramount enemy in Iran by the hawks in Washington, D.C. They need a regime full of Ahmadinejads. They don't want a bunch of Rouhanis and Zarifs who went to college in America and like to make deals and like to double extra prove beyond any historical precedent just how peaceful the nature of their civilian nuclear program is. You listen to the people like John Bolton. They said, well, the reason we were abusing the Iranians with all these false accusations is because we were trying to get them to renounce the Non-Proliferation Treaty and their safeguards agreement with the IAEA and kick the IAEA out of the country. We were trying to foment a crisis that would at least make it look like they had decided to go ahead and pursue nukes, because then we could go ahead and attack them.
Exactly. And it's amazing how similar the views of hardliners in Tehran are similar to the views of hardliners in Washington. Hardliners in Tehran don't want any nuclear agreement, don't want any relationship with certainly with the West, and they always want to be on a confrontational stance. They also have this extreme rhetoric about Israel, and as much as I oppose Israel's policies towards Palestinians, I think that the rhetoric that Iranian hardliners, and even their test, the missile test that they have to a large extent, is basically the manifestation of what they want. They want the country to be always on a war footing. They always want to be in a confrontational mode and a stance, so that under the guise of threat to national security, they can control everything. And, of course, we know it's the same thing in this country. They also want the United States to be on a war footing. They also want the United States to be confrontational with Iran and make accusations and provoke Iran so that they can find a justification to go to war with Iran and, at the same time, distract people's attention with all sorts of problems that we have in this country. I mean, as you and I and people like us know, since 2001, after the terrorist attack, this country has spent over $3 trillion on useless war in the Middle East. And at the same time, the infrastructure of our country is collapsing. So that's what they want, and that's what Iranian hardliners want. And as I said, it's amazing how similar their views are regarding war and peace.
Hey, Al Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottWhartonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? 1.5 bucks?
There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/Scott Horton Show. And thanks, y'all.
Yeah, well, it's really tragic. I mean, on the other hand, at least we have this nuclear deal now that, I mean, they can find another backdoor to war, I guess, if they want to gin up a worse conflict than is already taking place in Yemen or something like that. But it used to be for a very long time that the fake threat of an Iranian nuclear weapon or a program to make an Iranian nuclear weapon, that was the greatest pretext for war. And that has been put to bed thanks to Barack Obama's alliance with Vladimir Putin, by the way, is what helped to get that done. Nobody ever wants to talk about how heroic it was when Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin worked together with President Rouhani to pass this great de facto peace deal, is what it was. It turned down the burner on this tension by quite a lot, you know, whatever, however you measure those degrees. And then, you can see why the right wingers on both sides are so upset. But now, so can you tell us a little bit about this guy, Ibrahim, is it Raisi?
Raisi,
okay. Yes. I'm sorry, it's I can't tell the I's from the L's at the Huffington Post today for some reason. But anyway, please elaborate. Tell us, this is the guy that's looking to challenge Rouhani?
Yes. Right now, he's the custodian of this religious shrine in Iran. And this religious shrine, which is basically the gravesite of Shia's 8th Imam, has vast holding worth about $100 billion. So he has vast resources at his disposal. But politically, he has always been a member of the judiciary. And the judiciary in Iran has always been controlled by the hardliners, and in particular, Khamenei himself and Khomeini before him. And he has had a very major role in suppressing all activities of people who want a better country and want to move the country towards a better future. In particular, he played a major role in the execution of close to 4,000 political prisoners in the summer of 1988. In the summer of 1988, as Iran-Iraq war was ending, Iran had thousands of political prisoners. And Ayatollah Khomeini, who was still at that time the supreme leader, wanted to put the country in a position such that after the end of Iran-Iraq war, Iran would not have to deal with its political prisoners. So what he did was he formed a committee of four people. One from the judiciary, one from Ministry of Justice, one from security, and so on, to look at the situation with political prisoners. So what this committee did, of which Raisi was a major figure, was interviewing each and every one of these political prisoners, and they asked him whether they had changed their philosophy or political thinking while in jail. And I must say that none of them had received execution. They had all been sentenced to jail terms. So none of them were supposed to be executed. So they interviewed each and every one of them, asking them whether they had changed their thinking and whether they're loyal to the Islamic Republic and so on. And if they said no, they haven't changed their thinking, they would be immediately sent to be hanged. So between July 1988 and September of 1988, close to 4,000 political prisoners were executed. And the main culprit behind it, after Khomeini, was this committee, of which Raisi, the current candidate, was a major figure. When he became custodian of this religious shrine last year, the reformists and the Green Movement supporters, what they did was they began making revelation about his past activity, because we have a young generation in Iran which may not remember what happened in the 1980s, and older people may not also remember or do not know about what was happening in the 1980s, which was a very painful decade for Iran. So what happened was, the son of Grand Ayatollah Hossein Ali Montazeri, who was a very, very progressive cleric and supporter of the Green Movement, published the audio tape of a conversation that his father had with a member of this committee for execution of political prisoners. And in Iran, this committee is known as the Death Committee. So in the audio tape, he attacked them fiercely. And at that time, he was deputy supreme leader. So he had a lot of power. But he had opposed the execution, and he was attacking this. And he called Raisi, who is going to run for presidency, a criminal that history will judge him as criminal. He even said with utmost courage at that time that history will even judge Khomeini as a criminal because of these executions. So that hurt the image that the hardliners were trying to build for Raisi as, you know, sort of a pious man and all sorts of other good things that they were attributing to him. So that also provoked reactions on the side of the reactionary people. And they even arrested Montazeri's son, Ahmad, for publishing these audio tapes and sentenced him to 21 years of jail, and they threw him in jail. But then major clerics in Qom, the center of religious activity in Iran, opposed it quietly and basically told Khamenei that unless he's released, they are going to cut off all their relationship with Khamenei. And because Khamenei, although he's called Ayatollah, he's not actually an Ayatollah. He never had the credential for being Ayatollah. He relies for part of his religious legitimacy on acceptance by these major clerics. So if the major clerics tell him that, you know, if you don't do this, we are going to cut off our relationship, that is a major blow to him. So he immediately ordered his release, Montazeri's son, from jail. So he's free now, but that hurt Raisi's image. So now the deep state, as I call them, is trying its best to prop up Raisi. And, the national network of radio and television practically every day broadcast something about him and attribute something good to him and so on, so that they can bring him to power. Now, here is one important aspect of Raisi. Recently, he has had several speeches in which he has talked about the foreign policy. And in his speeches, he has been an ultra-hardliner, you know, taking very hostile attitude towards everything that was that's going on, not only in the Middle East, but everywhere else. He's talking about jihad, all sorts of things. And that is, although most people believe that it's basically just rhetoric and trying to provoke the hardliners supporters in Iran to come to the vote because they are not sure that their candidate can win. But still, you know, talking with this language is very dangerous. Because as we all know, neocons, war party in the United States, uses such rhetoric and such harsh words as an excuse to go after Iran. I mean, we all know that, for example, Ahmadinejad said that Israel will disappear from history's page someday, by which he meant that, you know, it will collapse in the way that the Soviet Union collapsed. But it was translated as he meaning that Iran will basically attack Israel and wipe it out from the page of history. And that, of course, was used as an excuse to take Iran to United Nations Security Council to impose sanctions and so on and so forth. So we know that this type of harsh language and rhetoric, even if it has no practical consequences, is really terrible for a country like Iran. And that is another dangerous aspect that this guy has.
Right. Yeah, I mean, this is a thing that comes up all the time. It's hard to explain to people that death to America is just a slogan. It's not the actual policy over there. Sort of like injustice for all is just a slogan here. It's something they say, but that's not actually what they're working on, bringing down the great Satan. But to the average guy, hey, that's what it seems like. Look at them all chant and burn their flag and blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. And in fact, Iran under Rouhani has been trying to expand its commercial relationship with the United States after lifting the sanctions. Iran signed a major agreement with Boeing to buy close to 100 aircraft. And Boeing just announced that another contract with another Iranian airline to buy up to 60 more aircraft. And as Boeing said, that this will create thousands of jobs in the United States. Iran has also have agreement with AT&T for communications, and Iran has been importing wheat and pharmaceuticals from the United States for years. And regarding that debt to America, first of all, as you said, this is just a slogan. And secondly, it is uttered by a tiny fraction of the Iranian population. And even then, most of them don't believe in it. But because they participate in these religious ceremonies, and hardliners usually run these religious ceremonies, you know, they shout it, and then that's it. That there is no consequences.
Yeah. But it's worth bringing up here that you look at how much Americans hate the Iranians, and it's because the Iranians overthrew a government that we had foisted on them, right? Yes. How dare they overthrow the Shah's regime? Where, look at it from the Iranian point of view, they actually had to suffer for 26 years under the tyranny of an American-backed dictatorship. So if you think about how mad Americans are that they overthrew the dictatorship we'd foisted on them, think about how mad we'd be if they'd actually foisted a dictatorship on us.
Exactly.
Death to America, death to Iran as a chant wouldn't be good enough. We would nuke them off the face of the earth one day, you know?
I totally agree. And in fact, that has been, you know, the point here all these years since the Iranian Revolution. The Iranian Revolution didn't result in the democratic state that we wanted. Although, comparatively speaking, Iran is in far better shape than the rest of the Middle East, except for Israel. If you compare Iran with every country in the Middle East in terms of social structure, the press, the regular elections, which are not democratic but very competitive and meaningful, Iran is far ahead. But the point has always been, and many Iranian people, whether they support the hardliners or the reformists, believe that the United States never accepted the legitimacy of Iranian revolution. It never accepted the legitimacy of a revolution against a regime that had been imposed on Iranian people after the United States, in collaboration with Britain, overthrew Iran's democratically elected government under Prime Minister Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh. And as Stephen Kinzer said in his book, All the Shah's Men, if Mossadegh had not been overthrown, Iran would have been a completely democratic country. We would not have had Iranian revolution. We would not have had a hostile relationship between Iran and the United States. And because of the Iranian revolution, political Islam, which always existed, was actually revived and led to other things. So perhaps, as Kinzer said, if Iran's democratic government under Dr. Mossadegh hadn't been overthrown, we may not have had the terrorist attacks of 2001, in fact.
Sure. Well, look at it. I mean, the U.S., Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan supported Saddam Hussein's attack on Iran in order to contain the Iranian Revolution, at which point the leaders of the Dawa Party and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, why, they fled to Iran.
To Iran.
They lived in Iran for 30 years until George Bush reversed his father's policy, or at least Ronald Reagan's policy, and got rid of Saddam for them. And then guess who came and took over Iraq?
Yes, exactly. That's precisely correct.
Which, and then again, you know, to quote Prince Bandar, hey, our support for Daesh. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is Prince Saud al-Faisal said, our support for Daesh is a response to your support for the Dawah.
Yeah, exactly.
So here we go. This is called a chain of events. By the way, yesterday was the 100th anniversary of Woodrow Wilson kicking this whole thing off by turning the tide in World War I, by breaking the stalemate
Yes.
And which led directly to communism, Nazism, World War II, the Cold War, the American Empire, support for the Mujahideen and Saddam and Iran and against them and all these things.
Yes. And let me mention this. Iran supported al-Dawah, but al-Dawah participated in elections in Iraq. And through votes and, and people's votes came to power, or at least shares power. Daesh, or Islamic State, on the other hand, is a purely terrorist organization that attacks innocent civilians, that has been trying to destroy both Iraq and Syria, and is supported by Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations of the Persian Gulf, which are supposedly our allies, the United States allies. And while the United States always confronts Iran for its support of terrorism, whether it actually exists or not, it never, protests or does anything about the fact that these Arab regimes are the biggest sponsors of terrorism in the Middle East and elsewhere. I mean, just look at September 11th. Out of 19 terrorists, 15 of them were Saudi Arabia citizens. All these leadership of Islamic State, Daesh, as we say in Arabic and Persian, are either citizens of Saudi Arabia or Jordan or Qatar or Emirates and so on. They're all Arab states in that region. And but we never do anything. At the same time, while we are protesting Iran's support of Syrian government, and also not mentioning that if Iran were not there, Daesh or Islamic State would probably have taken over Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, we are supporting Saudi Arabia crimes in Yemen by giving it arms, by giving it logistical support. And while we are lamenting the death of children in Syria, which we should, we don't say anything about Yemeni children that have been killed over the past 2 years. Just in the special operation, the operation that by U.S. Special Forces that was done a few weeks ago, 8 children, very, very young children, died. Saudi Arabia has been bombing this poor country for over 2 years now. And the United Nations, UNICEF organization, has reported that every 10 minutes, one child dies in Yemen. And who is the culprit? The regime that we support in Saudi Arabia. And the guns that we give to Saudi Arabia, and the logistical support that we give to Saudi Arabia, and the military advice that we give to Saudi Arabia, and we don't talk about it. And Obama had a major role in this, and we don't talk about it while we talk about the crimes that supposedly the Syrian government committed, or Iranian government committed, and so on and so forth. So
yeah. Well, and the bad news keeps coming, too, because I'm sure you saw this report in the Washington Post last week where they talked about this major escalation coming in Yemen. Because that's what Mattis wants, because he's obsessed with Iran and he believes this ridiculous myth that the Houthis are nothing but a proxy force for the for Iranian power, the new Persian Empire, whatever in the Middle East, this ridiculous narrative that they've constructed, how they're ready to invade and shut down the last port there where the Houthis and the civilians are able to get food relief in order to starve everybody into submission. And in the whole article, they barely even mention, oh, yeah, and of course, you know, we got to bomb al-Qaeda, too, because what they didn't say but was obvious between the lines is we'll be fighting for al-Qaeda, directly for al-Qaeda in this thing, again, just like in Libya, just like in Syria, just like we have been for the last 2 years, but we'll be escalating and giving them all the more advantage. So at least they're saying, well, and by the way, while the special forces are doing this, we're still going to have the CIA drone bombing al-Qaeda, so don't worry about that.
Totally
as kind of as sort of an afterthought in the Washington Post piece.
I totally agree. And we have to remember that even, for example, the New York Times says that there is no firm relation between Iran and the Houthis in Yemen. Houthis make 40% of the population in Yemen. And they have legitimate grievances. At the same time, it's not just Houthis in Yemen. It is actually a coalition between Houthis and part of the Sunni population.
Right.
So,
and the dictator who America supported for 25 years or so before they overthrew him and replaced him with this guy who's now lost out.
Exactly. So. And there was this wonderful article by Hugh Silterman, the Middle
East. That's right. Yeah, no, I interviewed him about it. Yeah.
Yes, yes, in the Middle East. And he said that...
It's called... Pardon for interrupting. It's called... I'm sorry, because I interrupted you. Now I have to interrupt you again to clarify. It's
no problem.
The article, it's Joost Hilterman, it's in foreignpolicy.com, and it's called The Houthis Are Not Hezbollah.
Precisely, yes. And in his very good article, he discusses how, you know, because of the relation between Iran and Lebanese Hezbollah, they are making the same connections with the Houthis in Yemen, but actually that's not the case. And even the New York Times said that before the Yemen war started, there was practically no relation between Iran and Houthis. But because Saudi Arabia attacked Yemen, and because there is this fierce rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia, Iranians may have given some small arms to Houthis just to make Saudi Arabia nose bloody. But there is no actually major connection between the two. But
yes.
Yet they always talk about it and they're obsessed about it.
Right.
And at the same time, as you said, by attacking Yemen, by doing all of this, they actually helped the cause of terrorist groups like Al Qaeda to go and recruit people and commit more acts of terrorism.
Right, and as Joost pointed out on the show, they're actually handing a giant victory to the Iranians. The Iranians don't even have to do anything. All they have to do is sit there and be lied about, and it looks like they're making this major, gain and challenge to Saudi power. They've been waging this war for 2 years. They're still not one inch closer to actually reinstalling Hadi in power.
Yes.
So the Ayatollah gets all this win without spending a dime.
Exactly. And what they say is that Iran is sending arms to Houthis, but what they don't say is how is it that Iran is sending arms to Houthis? Yemen has been surrounded, land, air, and sea, by Saudi forces, the coalition that Saudi Arabia has put together, and the U.S. Navy.
Right, and everybody knows that they have more weapons than grains of sand in Yemen, and they got a lot of them from America in the first place. And as you said, they're in alliance with the former government, the former dictator, and I don't know how many different army divisions, but it's not like they were for a real want of guns and daggers in Yemen.
Totally agree.
Crazy.
I totally agree. And this is just an excuse to not only expand the war, but also, go after Iran, for example. They think that if they defeat the Houthis and the coalition of which Houthis are one part, if they defeat them, then that would be a major defeat for Iran, which it would not be. If you're talking about victories and defeats, the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Ayatollahs in Iran have already won. Because, as you said, they haven't done a thing. They haven't moved a finger. And yet Saudi Arabia is deeply involved in this war that there is no end to it. And at the same time, it is bringing condemnation of the whole world. Close to 10,000 civilians have died. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced, refugees. And this is a country that before war was importing 90% of its food supply. And now because it has been completely surrounded by Saudi and U.S. forces, we are going to have a major famine and a starvation crisis. And there are all sorts of pictures on the internet that and reports that report on the state of hunger in Saudi Arabia. We don't talk about all of this, but Nikki Haley, U.S. ambassador to United Nations, sheds crocodile tear for Syrian children, which of course we also condemn and we also oppose, and we also feel pain for each and every one of Syrian people who die in this useless war. But what she doesn't say is the role of the United States in this savage war in Yemen, which is killing just as many children proportionally speaking, or even more, as the Syrian children that are being killed in Syria.
All right. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, Mohammed. It's always great to talk to you.
It is a pleasure to be in your program, Scott.
All right, y'all. That is the great Mohammed Sahimi. He teaches chemical engineering at USC, and he's been such a great critic of American Iran policy, and for that matter, such a great analyst of politics in Iran. And you have to check out this great article at the Huffington Post. It's called "Iran's Deep State Could Unseat Rouhani with a Khamenei-backed Hardliner in Upcoming Elections." And yeah, it's getting into the weeds, but you can do it. So do it. It's at thehuffingtonpost.com. I'm Scott Horton. Check out the full archives of these interviews at scotthorton.org/interviews and at libertarianinstitute.org/Scott Horton Show. They all get posted there first, so sign up for the RSS feed there. And follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Thanks very much, guys.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audio book of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.